stretch out, that your skin can bring you so much pain. Now I hear you say, you got the best of both ways. Won't you come and take a walk in my shoes, and tell me if you take my place. Under the cover of my skin.
Welcome, Inside Running Podcast listeners, albeit to the slightly softer tones than the usual three. My name is Sophie Ryan. I'm sitting alongside my dear friend, the lovely Kate Smythe.
Hi, Kate. Everyone. Hi.
How are you?
I'm great, Soph. How are you?
Very well. We are in Kate's lovely little unit that's tucked in behind my podiatry clinic in Melbourne's inner north, enjoying our Friday morning. And really looking forward to bringing to you some very interesting information. Today's topic that we're going to dive into, and we're going to skip a little bit of the banter and sort of get straight into our interesting content around iron and iron deficiency, anemia, and all things relating to iron, because Kate is a very experienced and highly credentialed naturopath. As well as being a phenomenal distance runner, as we well know, Kate. If you missed her episode with Julian, I think it was about the middle of last year in Ballarat.
Yeah.
Kate was a 2008 marathon representative in the Australian Olympic team that went to Beijing. She represented Australia in 2006 in Melbourne at the Commonwealth Games. She has a marathon PB of 2:28. And whilst that all is pretty amazing on paper, I think it's Kate's beautiful, warm, compassionate personality that, that I think has the most impact on runners and athletes day to day at the moment.
Oh, thanks, Soph.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I'm personally very interested in all things iron. I'm constantly managing my iron levels as a female distance runner. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. So I think we can bring a lot of interesting information to people today. Mm. We're going to have a really casual, authentic conversation and just touch on a lot of things. I'm going to pick Kate's brain as much as I possibly can. And we also have some time for some listener questions that some of the Inside Running Podcast listeners have sent in over the last few days. So if you're ready, I reckon we get straight into it.
Let's do it.
Fantastic. First and foremost, I think that to properly understand iron deficiency, we must first understand what iron actually is, where it's found in the body, and what it does. If you don't mind, give me a bit of insight into that.
Sure. So iron, most people know iron, obtain it mostly through their food. But iron, once it goes into the body, plays many, many roles. We often think of iron as the substance that goes into hemoglobin and helps sort of carry our oxygen around our muscles, especially to our working muscles. But we've also got to remember that iron has multiple functions within the body. For example, it supports our immune system. So that's one of the, we'll talk about some of the signs that people can feel, but that's or experience, but that's one of the things that people don't think of immediately. And so they'll get repetitive colds or things like that. And it can actually be more to do with their iron deficiency than anything else, because iron plays so many roles in the body. It also helps with lots of our enzymes, for example. Yeah. The enzyme that converts our energy into a form that we utilize through the there's two sort of processes with that, but the final process is called the transport electron chain. It is dependent on iron, iron for the enzymes to actually convert things to ATP. So, you know, it's no wonder we feel damn tired. It's not only because it's not, our body isn't oxygenating properly, but we're actually not converting our energy properly either.
Yeah.
So, iron's used for it's also used for protein metabolism, carbohydrate metabolism. Mm. It does a whole range of things in the body. So it's so important.
So important.
For runners, for athletes of any kind, but
for people in general.
For people, exactly. Mm. And you'll find also if people suffer from this, they also go, they feel like they're going a bit loopy in the brain, because it really does have effect on our neurotransmitters, because they need iron too.
It's incredible.
So you can feel like you're going insane. You know, you'll drop all these tears all the time, get really emotional, and you know, it's like, really, is that my iron? Yes, it can be.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So if we think of a red blood cell in the body, what is binding, or where is the iron? The iron element, isn't it? It is an element, isn't it? Oh yeah, I'm just thinking. Okay, so it's bound to red blood cells, isn't it? I'm tapping in. I'm trying to. I want to imagine.
You're getting very biochemical here. Do we really?
We don't need to. I just like imagining it in my body. Like I want to picture it. So it's it's a little red blood cell, and it's bound to the red blood cell, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. No, that's good. That's enough for me. I've just got these. Oh, good. We've got visuals. Visuals for the podcast. This is great.
I've just given Sophie a red blood cell.
No, that's great. That's what I needed. I just like to picture the little FE, which is the chemical symbol. You can tell this girl did a bit of science way back
when. You've got to remember, I think with anything, we've got to remember that the red blood cells only live for 120 days. They're not an everlasting thing. They're constantly evolving and turning over. Hence why we constantly need to fuel them. Yeah. We can't just have iron 1 month and then not have iron the next month.
Cheerio the iron.
You know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, that's helpful. Okay. So if that is what iron is, and that's what it does in the body, and that is where it's found, let's talk about being deficient in iron. Mm. And let's become more clear on the definition or the spectrum of iron deficiency. So I don't think you can go from just having really healthy iron levels to just nothing. There has to be a spectrum, surely, in terms of deficiency.
Yeah, and look, iron deficiency is one of those things that creeps up on you slowly. It's like a stealth. And you can feel a little bit like, once you've had it before, you can kind of start to see the signs and symptoms, but it's a little bit like a deflating balloon. You can have really good stores, and then gradually over time you'll deplete them if you're not replenishing them enough, or if there's other factors that we'll talk about in a minute. But it does, because of that stealth nature, the iron stores, and it depends how much you're utilizing by the body as well, in terms of how quickly you'll run out of it.
Right.
So some people with other conditions like digestive health problems, like celiacs, or even just a lot of inflammation in the gut, you can also find with, and this is an aside, if you've got inflammation in your body of any kind, there's a compound in your liver called ferroportin, which will be it can block the absorption of iron from your food when there's inflammation. So there's so many reasons why you might run out of iron, even though you've got good iron stores last month, they've gone this month.
There's
heaps of factors that can come. It's not just about the amount of iron-rich foods that you're eating. There's multiple things. And I think in terms of the progression, often we have to also keep this in mind, that often athletes are adaptive. They've adapted to certain levels of things. So we get, as endurance athletes, we get much more efficient with certain utilizing an uptake of things in our bodies. But with iron, we can churn through it so much so that we're not matching our demands. And it will start by the fatigue. You'll start seeing some symptoms initially. And then if you look at the pathology, iron might be fine, ferritin might be fine, but then the next month you might see the drop in ferritin, and slowly it will just start to tick down, tick down, tick down.
Gotcha.
You know, to the point where, oh, we're getting quite a lot more symptoms, and oh, this is not great. You know, we start to feel quite ordinary. Our performance really starts to slow down.
Park that word ferritin, because I'm going to come back to that. Is the definition of anemia iron deficiency, or severe iron deficiency?
No, look, iron you can have iron deficiency without anemia.
Right.
Anemia is really when the hemoglobin as such starts to drop.
Okay.
But you can feel rotten without the hemoglobin dropping.
Yeah.
Like you can still feel the signs of anemia, iron deficiency anemia, before you have the hemoglobin drop.
So you can be iron deficient but not be anemic.
That's it.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
But we've got to remember that there's multiple types of anemia without going into too much detail. I know we're talking about iron, but often what goes along with iron anemia, well, it can be often if people aren't eating red meat, they're not normally getting as much B12 yes. or iron.
Right.
So you could have two types of anemia coming in there. Mm. You can have the iron deficiency, which causes the smaller size red blood cell, which is called microcytic anemia, yep. micro being small
yep.
cell. And if so you could have it that way, which is more iron, but you can also still feel the same symptoms of anemia by having B12 deficiency, which gives you the big red blood cells.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you could still have anemia.
Yes.
Let's not get too caught up. I know we're talking about iron, but
No.
You can have different forms of anemia.
Yep.
And then there's what's called the pseudoanemia, which is more labelled sports anemia, which is an adaptive process that athletes have where their hemoglobin looks like it's dropping, yep. but the ferritin level's actually fine, or the iron's actually yep. fine. Yep. And that is not true anemia. Yeah. That's just the hemoglobin's dropping. And you see that in response. Like you see that straight after people race, say if yeah. they did a marathon, that drop, you know, or after a hard session, it would drop. So that's why I encourage people, if they're wanting to get their levels checked and stuff, don't do it straight, like within 3 days of doing a marathon.
Because
of that. And also because the inflammation would have increased, which, yeah, will impact yeah. things too. Yeah.
There are a lot of words you've just thrown out there that are giving me flashbacks to me getting my blood levels checked by a doctor. And then this is what standard practice for me is. I ring Kate, I send my blood levels to Kate, and Kate goes through them and we look at them together and she gives me advice. So words such as ferritin.
Yes.
Saturated ferritin, hemoglobin.
All those things, yeah. Touch on those for you.
Could you give a really quick definition?
So ferritin is your iron storage in the liver. Okay. That's like your storage tank.
And is the liver the only part... the only place in the body that stores
it's
iron.
The major.
The yes. major. Okay, cool. We're happy yeah. with major. Great.
Yeah.
So ferritin, stored iron in the liver.
Mm.
Carry on.
Yeah.
Hemoglobin.
So hemoglobin, let's just call that the carrier of everything.
Beautiful.
Through yep. the body. That's yep. easier. But actually the thing that transport, and I describe this like the tram if yep. we're in Melbourne.
Yes.
Or the train
not?
If we're in other states, that carries the iron through the body is the transferrin.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's when you look
helpful
at the
word,
saturation,
trans.
The yep. transferrin saturation, and that's how much of this iron's actually getting on that tram.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, because sometimes you can have high levels, but for whatever reason, it's not jumping on the tram.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, and if it's not getting on the tram, it's certainly not getting
it's
to
not getting
the, where it needs to go.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So yeah. we've identified ferritin, we've identified transferrin. Yeah. When you look at my levels and you talk about saturated, what are we talking about when we're talking about saturation?
Well,
and
that,
why is that pretty cool?
That was what I was sort of mentioning before. It's how much is getting on the
track. Oh, right. Gotcha. Yeah. Oh, that makes sense to me. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Hemoglobin. All right. So they're the main...
Yeah. They're the main things just to...
That a naturopath is going to look at.
Yeah.
We don't just look at our iron
and your red... Well, we're going to look at your red cell count,
yep.
obviously, and the size of that. Remember how I just talked about the micro or
yes.
macro
yep.
size? So red cell distribution width, we're going to look at that. So if it's yep. small, we know it's more likely, not always, but more likely to be iron related.
Yep.
If it's really big and the cell's huge, it's struggling with B12 or folate.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So when a person, let's talk about a listener of this podcast, gets their air quote iron levels checked, it's actually to really have an accurate picture of their status. It's about understanding all of those different aspects,
yeah,
what their role is and what their status is at that point in time.
Yeah,
because
I think some people can look at that and go, oh, my iron is actually fine, because the level of iron might look fine, but their ferritin might be really low.
Yes. Okay.
So that's just saying, oh, you don't have much in reserve.
Yeah.
Like,
I remember one day, yeah. Kate, you looked at my levels. This is probably 6 or 12 months ago. And there was one of my numbers had dropped since my previous blood test. But you said, no, that's okay, because another number had stayed really stable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just an example to people to know that. It's about looking at that whole picture.
Absolutely.
And understanding every element of...
And look, it's really fascinating in clinic how some athletes will feel absolutely fine with really low ferritin and others will be affected when it drops below 50.
Amazing.
It's really individual.
Yep.
Yeah.
So
and
really
that's why I say you've got to not just look at pathology, you've got to really... understand your signs and symptoms or the way you're feeling
yeah.
and use that as a guide
yeah.
as well Because if you just go by blood results, it's not always the right thing to do for you. Yeah, because you might be one of those super adapters that can just really function quite well. And I've known several Olympians that have got down to 15 and they've still been racing at Olympic level well.
Yeah.
And I just go, oh my goodness, where most people wouldn't be able to get off the couch.
Amazing.
Yeah, at that level.
One thing I've learned over the years being a patient of yours is we understand normal ranges, so a range between X and Y, but you've educated me over the years in terms of that's all good and well as a normal range, but we've got to be more aware of the athlete range.
Yeah.
Can you tap into that in terms of iron and people just maybe Googling what is a healthy iron level range for a, you know, male of this age and this weight or a female of this age and this weight? Mm. And I remember you saying, yeah, that's good and well for normal, air quote, but for an athlete it needs to be or should be looked at potentially being a bit different.
Yeah, so the and generally if we look at ferritin for those ranges, we look at 30 and the range goes way up. I think it's 30 to 150 off the top of my head, something like that, or even higher, maybe 100. About 100 instead of 150. But that, again, that goes back to how much you're utilising and the demands for oxygen in your body. So for an athlete, and I can see this as I just tapped on before, that if it drops below around 50, that people can really feel that they don't feel so good in an athlete. So if we're talking about optimal rather than pathology range, optimal would ideally be above 50 if they could. It just gives them a bit more reserves. Some people can get it really high. Others, the majority I've seen that are endurance athletes, sort of, they have to continuously work at it to keep it at that level or above.
Cool.
Yeah, through natural means is what I mean.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's talk about where can we get iron from?
And this is interesting because there's a lot of misinformation out there, but obviously the classic place where we get iron from that most people think of is red meat or animal sourced meats. And that is what we call heme iron. So there's two different kinds of iron that we get from our food: heme iron from animal-based things and non-heme from plant-based sources. They're quite different in that heme, they perform a similar role in the body. However, heme is much more bioavailable. The body prefers that source of iron.
So it can more readily take it up.
Take it up and utilize it. Gotcha. Whereas it's got to work a lot harder to do the non-heme, which means we need to be having a lot more volume if you're a vegetarian of those sources of foods, but you also need to be very mindful of all the cofactors and the interactions, which we can touch on as well, because they can really impede the absorption. You can be doing everything you thought was the right thing, but if you're, for example, having red meat and then you're having cheese and yogurt, the calcium in that will be impacting on the absorption of the iron. Like if you're having it really close together for dessert after a main meal, like it's counteracting it. But on the other side, there's lots of great things you can do.
That's actually one thing I've learned.
Increase the absorption.
Definitely one thing I've learned from you over the years is about what we eat with the pairings sort of thing. So give us a couple of
the foods that are really this is this one sometimes raises eyebrows, but
go for it.
Being in Australia, if I'm not,
I know where this is going.
Skippy does actually have. It is actually one of the richest sources. I don't like to call them that. I love them, but they do actually. They're a beautiful lean source of iron and protein,
right?
And they are readily available now through our food source, through supermarkets now.
Okay.
So if people are open to that, I do encourage them to have some roux if they're meat eaters. But now, you know, the other common ones, lamb and beef are the other ones. But other meats like chicken, fish, for example, there is also what we call the iron meat factor. So if we're having the vegetarian-based sources of iron with the meat, it will enhance the absorption overall of everything. It's like a synergistic
effect. Cool.
The two work together. So that's great, because when you're having a meal, typically you'll have meat with something. You know, you might have grilled spinach. You might, sautéed spinach. You might have other things that are rich in iron that you whack together.
And they work together.
And they work together.
Yeah, beautiful.
Which is good.
Vitamin C with iron. Does vitamin C increase the absorption?
It sure does.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, absolutely. There's quite a few things that we can take to enhance iron absorption. Yep. So it's not just, and I'll touch more on the vegetarian things. I haven't forgotten about those because that's okay. Important. But so vitamin C most definitely helps the iron to be absorbed and utilized, but it's also the acid, like citric acid, that we find packaged,
right?
Like an orange, for example.
Yep.
You'll find the acid actually helps the iron.
Yeah, okay.
As well.
Yeah.
So a simple tip for vegetarians is when, say, you're having dal or something with lentils, like a lentil soup, whack a tomato in there, because it's got the acidic base, but it's got the vitamin C as well.
Nice.
So that's a nice little tip that's really super easy to kind of think of. Just package things together in a meal, and then it becomes quite easy.
Yep.
But other vitamin C-rich foods, which most people, I think, would be very familiar with, things like red capsicum, you know, we've got our berries and all, you know, we think of fruit usually, but if you're on a low sugar diet or whatever and you can't have many fruits, you're fructose intolerant or whatever else, you can get heaps from veggies.
Vitamin C,
Vitamin C,
veggies, awesome.
Yeah.
And for listeners who are frantically writing all this down, do not worry, we will provide links to this information via Kate's website and various other things. So if you're out running at the moment or commuting by bike or something and you just want to be taking all this down, I can understand why. Don't worry, just enjoy listening to Kate, absorb it, and we'll provide links a little later on.
So vegetarians,
yeah,
we touched
sorry.
On the vegetarians, yeah. This is, I guess, something that I deal with on a regular basis with runners that choose to be vegan or vegetarian is, you know, they need a lot more. And some of the sources, the non-heme sources, which is the plant-based sources again, can be quite rich, but we've got to remember we need a lot more of it. And you know, if you look at the comparison, it's like up to 35% of our meat-based sources will be absorbed, the iron from that, but only like 3 to 20% of our veggie-based sources. So we just need a heap more. But we also just need to remember that some of the iron-rich vegetarian sources, like lentils and spinach, for example, and other leafy greens, kidney beans, things like that, that are rich in iron, they actually also have things like phytates or oxalates in them. They're things that can actually inhibit iron. Now, that's not to say you should not have those foods. You should. But they're simple little things, are like soaking your beans adequately, cooking them. Have sautéed spinach instead of raw spinach in your smoothie. A simple thing like that will allow you to access the iron without the phytate binding it and inhibiting the absorption of it.
Yeah, that's great advice.
Yeah, really little simple things to do. And things like soy and chickpeas also have that phytic acid, but I don't believe, not many people have raw soy, like it's not that common to have. Some people might have edamame, but you know, it's more common to have it cooked anyway, so it's not usually a big problem for people with that.
Tofu uncooked, is that raw soy?
That's raw soy,
okay.
but tofu has been fermented, so
course,
most people do cook it or grill it or whatever. I think the silken probably is the one that you might put into desserts, you know, that's but not that many people use the silken all the time.
Very good. Do you want to say anything more about dietary stuff and where we can find it before I
and there's I didn't really touch on some of the other simple things, the things with non-heme iron or the vegetarians. We just need to also remember just to have lots of different sources of it throughout the day, so you won't be able to get it from one food source. You won't be able to go, oh, I've had my spinach, I've had my iron, because of the volume that you need. As an athlete, you need at least 23 plus milligrams per day, which if you add it up, you have to need, you actually need to eat iron quite frequently during the day. Like nearly every meal needs to be containing iron, and if you're a vegetarian, absolutely everyone does. Like you don't have much leeway there. So there's simple little things you can add to things, like instead of having honey on your porridge or something like that, you could add blackstrap molasses, which is rich in iron. You could add some dried figs, for example, which has also got iron. If you don't mind eggs, you can have some eggs. Tahini, you know, put some tahini on it, which is yummy. And you could make a beautiful quinoa salad that has sautéed spinach in it with beans and other things in it. You know, there's great ways you can combine it to make it iron rich.
Yeah, yeah, that's very good advice, Kate. Thank you. All right, let's have a think about a runner out there who's never actually given a whole lot of thought to this whole iron conundrum.
Yeah.
But let's say they've never had their bloods done and they actually are iron deficient. What might they be feeling day to day, and what might they be feeling in their long runs and their track sessions that may, you know, trigger them to think, oh, actually, maybe I'm not just a bit sleep deprived, and maybe I'm not just a bit, you know,
tired from training.
Yeah. Maybe yeah. this could be a little bit more to it.
Yeah.
What might they be feeling?
Yeah. Look, some of the telltale signs initially, obviously it is the fatigue, but it's more than fatigue. It's like, oh, why can't I do this session anymore? You know, what's wrong with me? 2 weeks ago, I nailed this session and this week I'm feeling horrid.
Yeah.
And it's that shortness of breath people often get. It's that exercise intolerance, which is when you might be at the same speed you're feeling it's much harder than normal. You can get dizziness. A lot of people get that from getting up or lying down, like if they sit down to do their shoes, bend over to do their laces, up getting up they feel dizzy. We start seeing, as iron deficiency and anemia progresses, we start seeing more obvious symptoms. And we can see changes in things like nail beds, where the nails will go quite pale. They may actually, what we they can curve up, so they go spoon shaped. They're quite different shape. You can notice things on the tongue as well, like the tongue will often go pale. It might actually get a burning sensation and actually get quite painful on the tongue. It can actually go quite beefy as well, like there's a few different things on the tongue that can be picked up as well. We'll notice the conjunctiva, which is that below our eyelid, when we pull our bottom eyelid out, that can be really pale as well.
Instead of rosy red,
and our whole complexion can actually look quite pale as well. But feeling is usually that fatigue and that lethargy, and there's no spring in your step anymore. You're tired even though you're getting heaps of sleep. And you're not necessarily changing the amount of exercise you're doing or the intensity. You can get, if you're wearing a Garmin and you look at your heart rate, you can notice that your heart rate might be a bit higher, sometimes a lot higher, even though you might be jogging. That's often a bit of a telltale sign. You can get extra coldness. Like hands and feet, you can also, those colds and flus that I mentioned before, you've noticed you'll pick those up a bit more. I think they're they're the most common ones that I see in people. A bit of muscle weakness sometimes. And look, I used to have this warning signal in my body because I used to get anemia a lot. And my feet used to get really sore.
I was about to ask you to go through this. Can you tell us about this?
And this is because of the iron and B12 often being deficient at the same time. And I would often get the B12 tested and I'd be low. And B12's needed for our nerves and for our peripheral nerves. So you can get pins and needles, you can get pain in your nerves, and it's often at peripheral, so hands or feet will be where we feel it the most. And I guess also because there's pressure on your feet because you're running all the time. That was just where I used to feel it the most. So my feet used to just ache and I'd be like, why? I've changed my shoes, I've done all the right things, I'm not running on hard surfaces. And it would just start to get worse. And I'd just like, okay, I need to get my iron checked.
Wow.
And sure enough, bingo, there it'd be. Which I think we get good at getting used to being tired, especially if we're training for a marathon or something even longer. We come to accept it and we're trained to push through it. But sometimes you've got to really go, actually, I just need to check and balance here. I need to just make sure everything's okay. And if you check and you're fine, well, hey, that's okay.
Might be something else. Or
yeah,
I remember for me, 2006 was the first time I'd ever experienced this. I was about 18 years old, and I was on the track, and I just couldn't get lactic. I couldn't
push hard enough.
I just couldn't. There was nothing in me. I just could not get lactic. And Aunt De Castella was my coach at the time, and I said, I can't do these 400s and I can't even get lactic. It's not that I'm lactic and I'm running, my legs are heavy. I can't even get to lactic. Yeah. And he said, okay, you need to get your iron checked. And sure enough, I was deficient in iron. Anyway, they are really important signs and symptoms for people to be aware of. It's a silly question because I know the answer and I'm sure all the listeners know the answer, but should every runner be getting their iron levels checked?
Well, if you're doing high volume and you're getting symptoms, like you're getting the extra fatigue, there is no harm in getting that checked. Yep. I encourage people, if they're doing a lot of running, I encourage them to get it checked fairly regularly, like at least every 3 to 6 months, at least.
And if someone has never done this before, what do they do to have their iron checked?
Yeah, look, there's multiple ways you can do it. You can go to a nutritionist or a naturopath. You can go to a GP. All of those people can actually give you a referral to get iron tests completed. That would be the first test, because you should never assume. Yeah. Never assume, because iron's one of those things that if you overload on iron, like if you decide, okay, I'm going to self-prescribe and take an iron supplement,
you can
actually become toxic from iron.
Totally.
And it can actually store in your liver and cause other issues in your body. So not a great idea to self-medicate with iron. And go and get it checked first.
As wonderful as Google is, Google won't tell you your iron levels without you getting a blood test.
Always seek professional help first.
Yeah, it's literally as simple as having a chat to a nutritionist, a naturopath, or your GP. They'll write you a referral. You go and get your blood taken, and within 24 hours.
But at the time, it's always good to check your. I always recommend trying to get B12 checked at the same time and folate, which is often, in a package in the pathology. And if someone's getting lots of aches and pains and you can tell they've got inflammation, even ESR will help because that's an inflammatory marker. So if you've got acute inflammation, that will also skew the iron results because we've got this great adaptive process where our ferritin will actually go up. If there's allergy or an infection or inflammation in the body because the body's trying to pull it out of blood circulation and starve off the pathogen or whatever is in there. It's pretty cool when you think about it, but you've got to take that into consideration. If someone's come in to see you and they've they've got a cold and then they go and get their bloods taken for iron, it's going to skew the results. So I encourage people, if they've got a cold and flu, just wait, because you won't get the accurate level.
Of course.
Just wait.
And as Kate said before, if you've just done a fairly significant endurance event or something and you've got your referral in the car, wait till the body has settled.
Yeah, a few days at least. Like, give yourself 5 days a week and then check. And then don't go into your blood test straight after you've done a session.
Yes.
Not only are you going to be dehydrated, but it's going to change because you would have just stirred things up a bit.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. All right. That's cool.
Yeah.
Let's have a talk about men versus women. And what you see in clinic typically. Can we have a talk about some of the differences between
So anemia prevalence is a lot higher in women because of the multiple factors of the way that we can lose blood, but there's a lot of common ground, so I still see men that are anemic. But generally speaking, anemia rates, it varies depending on what research you look at, but generally they're much lower, like 4 to 10%, whereas women are much higher, 20, I've seen stats as much as 50%. So, and it depends on what kind of runner you are, but in terms of the volume, but there's a lot of common ground why both sexes will still develop iron deficiency anemia, at least anyway.
Yeah.
And that's because we lose blood through multiple means that we don't necessarily think of.
Yeah.
When we're pushing a lot, for example, in sessions or especially in races, we have lots of things going on in our body that cause us to lose blood. Mm-hmm. We can lose it through our digestive tract. So there's a lot of extra contraction. There's a lot of blood going out of that area and extra friction and things that can go on in the digestive tract when we're pushing like hard. So we'll get what's called occult blood. So we won't necessarily see it in our stool. And runners can think, well, I can't be losing it that way. I don't see it. Yeah. But it's these microscopic amounts that we lose every day from a hard session or a long run or whatever that add up and accumulate over time. So, and if people are inflamed in the gut, if they've got bloating or digestive issues, that's one sign that they've got a bit of inflammation, for example. They'll lose it a lot more quickly. If they're a celiac, for example, it's not only difficult to absorb it, but if they're not managing their celiacs well, there can be just, you know, there's lots of things going on, so they'll lose it more quickly as well. We also lose that through our urine. So I used to get this a lot. After all my marathons, I'd have rusty urine, like red rusty urine. And that's because of the bladder friction often. And as you get dehydrated, you know, things get dehydrated. But we've got to also think about our bodies when we're running. There's a lot of pounding, a lot of bouncing. And that can cause the bladder friction as well. And you may not necessarily feel it, but you'll notice it when you go to the loo and go, oh, crikey. And that'll tend to...
And that's not just dehydration and change of colour.
It can be that a bit, but, you know, that tends to be the more orangey, darker colour. But when it goes red rusty, it's really like, oh, that's blood in there. But usually that rectifies within a few days, even, you know, 48 hours, it's back to normal, especially if you're doing the right hydration and everything. It usually goes back to normal. If it doesn't, always get checked. Because that can be other things. It can be urinary tract infections or kidney problems, or always get checked. And the same with blood in stool. That is a absolutely always get that checked immediately. So we do lose it that way. We also lose it in very small amounts through footfall. It's called hemolytic. You probably heard that term. You would have, Sophie. You would have seen quite a bit of this in your in podiatry. But footfall actually can break up our red blood cells. But we've got this unique mechanism in that we can, when we break up a red blood cell in our body, whether that through the feed or other means, through injury, our body actually scoops up the iron that comes out of the red blood cell and recycles it.
Oh, brilliant.
Isn't that cool?
That is so cool.
So it's not that we won't have some contribution from hemolytic, from footfall, but it's not a major contributor.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but
it's worth noting.
It's worth noting, absolutely. Yeah. And you know all the things that people could be doing to minimise that.
That's interesting about, I think we just so often think blood loss equals potential iron loss, but...
No,
so
I mean,
much more. That digestive stuff.
The digestive stuff is really big. And I think, obviously, women menstruate and a healthy athlete will be balanced and still have their cycles. So we want them to. Often it's a bit lighter in athletes, so that they're not necessarily heavy bleeders, but they still are losing some. But we should be able to have enough through our diet to manage that. Like, that's not a new phenomenon. That's just like what just happens, but it's these other means that's unique to runners.
When should a person be taking an iron supplement? Is it only if they have if their iron levels or their ferritin or whatever it is at a certain level that they should be supplementing?
I think this is so independent,
right?
And it's obviously something that really needs to be discussed with a practitioner,
right?
Because because those other factors will come into play. So if there's inflammation there, or if someone's unwell, giving them iron is not the right thing at that point in time because you're feeding the pathogen. Remember how we so I think that's it's not a once, it's not a blanket. You
if
must
this is
have
your
iron.
Number, this is your pill.
No. And it depends on whether you're seeing those signs and symptoms that we talked about, the fatigue and the shortness of breath and stuff.
Iron supplementation can be capsule form, it can be liquid form. Can you touch quickly on the different kinds of supplements? Supplementation that's available?
Most supplementation is through tablet these days. There is a new form that is a chewable tablet that's just come out that's a little bit gentler on the tummy as well. There are lots of mainstream supplements that use a ferrous iron. And we're not going to mention brands or anything today, but it's a really common one. And some people find that that's okay to bring their levels up. Others find that binds them up and they get constipation. Yeah, okay. So a bisglycinate is another form of iron that you can find in a supplement that is a little gentler for most people. And I rarely see anyone who has constipation with that form of iron supplementation. But again, you've got to check whether this is appropriate for you.
Of course.
There is also other supplements that contain lactoferrin, which again, the lactoferrin is working through that pathway where there might be some liver inflammation. So the lactoferrin will actually calm down that pathway as well as provide an iron bisglycinate or another form of iron in a tablet together. The liquid ions are out there, definitely. They're usually the non-heme ions, so you need a lot more of them. But you also need to just be... The liquid's great in terms of absorption, but they're usually in very small doses in terms of equivalent iron. So you just got to be mindful. That may be a choice. It's great for certainly people who can't swallow tablets or young kids or what have you, but you're going to need a lot more of that for the equivalent of the iron tablet. And there is certain situations which, again, you have to seek medical advice for this, which is obvious, but some athletes may actually, for example, celiacs or people with chronic issues where we need to bypass the gastrointestinal tract, say for parasites and things like that, then possibly an iron infusion is the way to go. But we just need to be mindful that iron infusions are not something that you should be relying on all the time. You need to be doing all the other good dietary stuff.
And probably understanding why you're iron deficient in the first place.
Absolutely. You've got to go back to the root cause, because just providing patches repetitively can actually have flow-on effect longer term. For example, too much iron in huge amounts repetitively, like infusion after infusion after infusion, can cause problems later down the track. And the iron actually goes into tissue, so it will start going into your liver, and your liver literally gets rusty. It'll go into your joints, so your joints will get stiff and sore, and you won't notice it immediately. It'll happen accumulatively over years. So it's always good to go back to the root cause and then treat the root cause, and then you can, you know, move forward with that and hopefully prevent issues. Not only issues with having too much, but the issues of even getting anemic in the first place. And that's why checking all the time, getting those regular checks is good, because it can take up to 8 weeks before you feel good again. Who wants to sit out for 8 weeks if they've got a major event coming up that they work their ass off for?
Like, who just wants to feel shit for 8 weeks? Not at all.
Totally.
Enough as it is. Kate, I do want to move on to some listener questions,
but
I just want to make a, just kind of summarize all of that. If our listeners are out there, they haven't really given much thought to this ever. It is probably something to, you know, really tune in with your body and think about some of those telltale signs that Kate mentioned. And if you do think that perhaps you are iron deficient, make an appointment to see someone, I think.
Yeah, that's the key. That is the key.
And
If anyone's interested in just getting an idea of the common things that they may be feeling that might be related that they're not sure of, they can always do my quiz.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about this, the quiz?
So it's just a free quiz, and they can get that on my Instagram page, which is Kate Smyth, Sports Naturopath, or on my website, which is athletesanctuary.com.au.
Okay.
And it's just a free quiz, and they just fill out a couple of questions, and it will give them an idea whether they're likely or unlikely to have anemia, in which case it'll give you an idea, okay, I urgently need to see someone about this, or less likely, and I'll just need to have more food sources of my iron, for example.
Yeah. Okay, so people, I think every single person should go on, and I think they should do this quiz. So Kate Smyth, I'm not trying to pump her up. I'm just, honestly, this is really important. I have, this is...
It's free.
I have a duty of care. Kate Smyth, Sports Naturopath on Instagram, or theathletesanctuary.com.au.
Yes.
Jump on. We will link to this in show notes, but jump on and just answer the questions in the quiz and get a bit of an idea of where you may or I guess where you might be at. And we'll also link all of Kate's details, because you can see her, as I've done many times, as a patient. So you can see Kate and get her naturopathic advice by consulting with her in one of her three clinics or via Skype consultations. All of the information for this is on her website, athletesanctuary.com.au. But yeah, this is obviously something that's it's so common in runners and endurance athletes, triathletes and everything. And it's nothing to be worried about. It's just something to be really mindful of and keep on top of because, yeah, long-term health is really important.
Absolutely.
For sure. All right. You want to get on to some listener questions?
Let's do it.
Okay. I'm happy to answer this first one if you want me to. This was sent in via Instagram by Royson_Kelly1. And she asks, if I only had time for physio exercises or strength, which would you do and why? So what I'm interpreting from this question is that if you're injured, you've seen a physio, they've given you specific exercises for that injury. Let's just go with an Achilles injury, for example. I'm interpreting that you're time poor and therefore you're having to decide, do I do the exercises that my physio has given me for my rehab or do I just do my normal strength and conditioning? My advice for this would be that if the physio has done a thorough assessment and you really do have a pathological Achilles that's giving you some grief, I would really put some time and effort and energy into exactly what's being prescribed to you in terms of the number of repetitions, the duration. I mean, if that's what you've been prescribed, I would do that. If it does mean that your strength, you know, your core stability stuff has to take a little bit of a break because you're extremely time poor, well, so be it. But I do think that following the guidance of a practitioner is absolutely critical if you're genuinely serious about rehabbing that injured area. It's obviously, it would be great if you could just squeeze it all in, but I understand the nature of being time poor. So my advice, if you only have time for physio exercises or strength, get on top of the injury, get it right, get yourself better, follow your rehab program, and then hopefully pretty soon after you can get back to doing you know, your full strength and conditioning program. But yeah, follow the advice of your physio.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I totally agree with that one.
Okay, we might jump on to that one.
Yeah, I totally do that one.
Yep, cool. So the village crazy lady asks, periods during a longer event, how do you deal with that?
That's a topic onto its own, and I'd really encourage everyone to jump on. We'll be doing a future podcast around female hormones and cycles and everything in the future, but this is something that concerns women a lot. But it's actually the early stages of our periods are actually when we can actually perform at our best. Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't try and mask that. It's actually quite hormonally favorable for us to be running when we've actually got a period, which a la Paula Radcliffe knows all about. You know, she broke the world record and had a period. Like, brilliant. Way to go, woman. But the in answer to that question, there's lots of things. I assume that you're meaning through management of blood loss. And look, most marathons do have toilets, so you can change tampons during that event. But the other option that a lot of women are now using are the menstrual cup.
Yeah.
And that holds a lot. So you wouldn't, in a normal long run, and you might be out there for 4 or 5 hours, even 6 hours, the menstrual cup would be more than sufficient to capture all that blood loss. So that's an easy one for people to consider.
Yep.
And it's great for our environment and it's actually good for us.
Yeah.
So it's just another option people can think of.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we will do another episode on all of this because there's so much to dive into. When I read this question, I interpreted it two part. I thought the symptoms associated with having your period and then the actual bleeding.
Yeah, right. Well, the symptoms are something you can actually...
Bleeding's almost the easy part.
The easy part, yeah. Because you just... The symptoms, yeah. If you're getting PMS, there's lots of things you can do prophylactically. So before you know your period's coming on. And again, we'll touch on this in another podcast. But things like magnesium can be great at dampening down the cramping side of things. Ginger, turmeric, all those things that are nice and anti-inflammatory are good.
Kate set me up with a lovely crampies supplement.
Yeah, so I've often that's a bit of a winner, that one.
Supplements from Kate for dealing with, I think 5 of my 7 marathons, I've had my period.
Yeah, wow. Interesting.
Like, how does this work? I'm sure the next one I'll be fine. Oh, no. Off we go again.
Well, that's good. It's performance enhancing almost for you.
Shame about the cramping, but anyway. Okay, we might move on to, here's a good one. What are some natural remedies for inflammation and joint health? And that's come from Nicole.5.Avery.
Yeah, cool. So inflammation and joint health is a big one for runners, obviously. And there's a few things that you can do that are natural remedies. Again, it's good to see someone because of the therapeutic range. You'll often find retail supplements have got the right ingredients in them, but they may not be at the right dose.
Yep.
So you'll need a lot more of them than if you get a high grade product.
Yep.
But just generally speaking, we're not doing individual prescribing here, but generally speaking, things like turmeric are great, and high quality fish oil, pardon?
Curcumin,
that's the active ingredient in turmeric.
Oh, right, sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're sort of talking about the same.
Yeah, it's the compound that actually is the anti-inflammatory.
Oh, shut up over
so
here.
You will see that on a label.
Listen
though,
to and the naturopath.
You will see it on a label, and it is the same thing.
Okay, cool. Fish oil.
Fish oils are something that you've got to take for several months. It's not like a quick fix.
Yeah.
Boswellia is another herb that's really lovely, anti-inflammatory, specific for the joints.
Yeah.
Devil's claw is another one. But these things need to be under the guidance of someone who's trained in herbal medicine.
Of course.
Other food stuff, as you touched on, ginger is a really nice nice one. You can find supplements that have got things like chondroitin, MSN and glucosamine in them. Natural forms of things like that are your good old bone broth.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
Yeah.
All health food stores have your big bone broth things.
Yeah, but you can make it at home and it's so cheap and easy.
Yeah. Give us a quick rundown.
Just get bones. It's like you're making a soup. You get hot water, throw your favorite veggies in there, bones, and cook it, like slow cook it for you could do it in your slow cooker for 8 hours. Bingo, you got bone broth. And then you can defreeze it in small amounts and just have half a cup a day. You can have it like a soup, so you can add extra stuff to it. You can use it as a base for your casseroles. You can just, like, it's easy.
That's
a package that's got lots of goodies in it, like collagen that we need for other parts, for our joints anyway.
Yep.
So that's a really easy tip for people to start using at home.
Yeah. Great answer. Thank you. I'm just going to quickly ask this one, Kate. And this question comes from James Friend, and he asks, what are some alternatives to protein shakes post long run? So I dare say James has come in from the long run a fair few times and whipped up a protein shake and maybe getting a bit sick of it and wants some other options. Or perhaps has seen a lot of people doing protein shakes and thinks, nah, that's not for me, but I know I need my protein after my long run.
Yeah.
What can I do?
Oh, I just have real food.
Good food.
Good food. Like, take some boiled eggs. You can have canned tuna on crackers.
Yep.
You can just basic food, grilled chicken.
Yep.
Just,
and the body's craving food.
Real food is great. We shouldn't be relying on our protein powders. I know I encourage people, if they're struggling with their protein, to use it in a smoothie because it's easy. You can have it in the car while you're traveling after your session. But there really is no substitute for just a real meal.
Proper meal.
But if you're vegetarian, you can get protein from having a good quality, loaded quinoa salad, as long as it's got lots of extra protein in it and you're protein combining. So you're getting, if you think of protein combining, if you're a vegetarian, eat like a Mexican.
Yeah.
They have beans, they have corn, they have rice, or quinoa, so you're getting the whole package together.
Yep. And I know I've seen on your Instagram and your website some great little recipes for protein balls that people
I love making protein balls.
You can actually
load the protein ball with some protein powder in it as well and just blend it up with nuts and seeds and some, don't go too heavy on the dried fruit because you'll end up well, not only that, but you'll going crazy with your sugar cravings and stuff. So just balance that out, but they're really easy to take with you and just snack on them.
It's so easy to just do a big batch of protein balls, put them in a jar or container
or in the freezer. And they keep really well
and just pick on them each day. And if if you drive somewhere to do a long run, chuck a few in a container with you, take it, and then after you've finished your run, get them in your body straight away.
It's
a fairly simple.
And look, there is a lot of protein bars and stuff out there, but I say you're better off having real food than wrapped in plastic. That's my rule, is try to stay away from plastic, anything packaged as much as you can, because then you're getting whole foods, and whole foods are going to have
if it comes from a plant, eat it. If it was made in a plant, don't.
Oh, that's a great saying.
Here we go.
That's
a great saying.
Awesome. Okay. And then we have a question from Lanesh, I think you pronounce the name, _0809. And the question is, how many miles or percentage of normal mileage the week before a 10K or a half marathon? Any rest days? So I'm thinking this is a question around tapering.
So coaching. Yeah. So cool. This, again, is so individual. It really depends on what you're used to and how you respond to a taper. 10Ks
probably also depends if it's a goal race or you just...
Yeah, or if you're running through it and using it as a training benefit.
I'll frame this into a little... So let's say it's a half marathon. We're going to answer the half marathon component. So okay. It's a half marathon and let's say it's their goal race.
Mm.
So this person wants to know how many... percentage of normal mileage week before and
you
any
could,
rest
you
days.
Could go way down, 40-50%, and you would perform really well.
Yeah.
If you're going to go too high, like if you're going above 80%, you're not really tapering, you're not really focusing on this race, which is fine if you're just training through it. But if you really want to make this a benefit, you would have a couple of rest days, but you need to trial it because some people get really stiff and sore on rest days. So rest days does not mean you sit on the couch. A rest day might mean you're still active and going for a light swim or a walk or... Yeah. Something that you're used to doing. Don't try something new on a rest day.
Yep.
If you're used to doing yoga, do a yoga class.
Yep.
But rest days are good just before a race. It's beneficial. You're not going to gain extra adaptation or training benefit by going out and doing a hard session before your race.
Also, I was going to say, if travel is involved, sometimes it might be a really early start, then you're traveling all day and fitting a run is actually just impractical.
Yeah. But going for a light run, if you're getting off a plane for 30 minutes or something, is hugely beneficial to stretch out those hammies and...
Get moving again.
Yeah. And if you're going overseas, then of course you've got to adapt to time zones and stuff. So that would help with that too.
Yeah. I'd be saying if it's a goal half marathon, let's say it's a Sunday, as a lot of them are, my Sunday long run the week before would be significantly shorter. It would probably be more like 80 to 90 minutes at max. My Monday would probably be fairly similar. My Tuesday would be a modified workout, but it would still be a session.
Yep.
And then my Wednesday wouldn't be a medium long run. It would be something a lot shorter. Thursday would probably be still an effort, but probably very modified. And then Friday and Saturday, I'd be jogging with a few strides.
Yeah.
And that would probably bring my mileage down to probably 60 to 70% of my weekly mileage. I probably wouldn't have a rest day unless, as I said, it was a travel day or... I felt like I really needed it. I find 20 minutes and strides is great, is probably equivalent to a rest day for me. But if I was really feeling it, I'd absolutely have a rest day. But I do like, I'm a bit of a creature of habit, I like the continuity, consistency, that sort of thing. And I guess if it was a 10K, it would be all of those things. The long run the previous Sunday might be a little bit longer. The Tuesday workout might be a little bit longer. But if you're serious about having a real crack at a race, you're not getting fit in that last week.
No. So your classic, Tuesday sessions where you might do 1Ks, you do something shorter, like a monofartlek or something
totally.
Like that.
Totally. Yep.
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 Yeah.
Cool. I think we've answered, oh my gosh, we didn't answer this question. I'm going to throw this at you. Why do elite, this is back to the Village Crazy Lady who, and she would like to know, why do elite women runners wear the briefs, not split shorts like the blokes?
Oh God.
hang on, briefs, not split shorts. Okay. No, I don't wear briefs. So I can't answer this. I don't know what
I hate briefs. I had to wear briefs sometimes and I hated them. I always feel like I was running around in my underpants.
I don't wear briefs because I don't feel like I'm elite enough. I've always classified.
You like shorts.
Yeah, no, I always look at women who wear briefs and I'm like, yeah, they're the big dogs. They're the real thing. And I wear shorts.
I think, is that coming from the way that we might go to the loo? Is that what she's coming from? Because I think men have different anatomical ways of releasing.
They do indeed.
I don't know whether that would really work for us.
I don't know. I do wear split shorts a little bit for training, like occasionally in summer, but I don't own a lot of them. So if I don't train in them, I'm certainly not going to race in them. As I said, I don't wear briefs, but I do wear fitted shorts for racing. And I don't know. There's something about feeling.
I don't mind shorts and I don't mind tight.
Tight shorts, like the proper fitted little shorts. But yeah, I personally don't wear briefs. I can't answer why women don't wear split shorts, but I dare say, as Kate said, it could be a little bit about why the blokes do in terms of relieving themselves, but it also might be because they train a lot more in them.
Yeah.
So they're a little bit more used to them. But yeah, look, I don't know.
Anyway. Yep. Yeah. I don't think there's one way or no right way or one way. It's whatever works.
Whatever you want.
Feel comfortable with.
Absolutely. We're going to wrap it up. Kate, you have been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much. I've learned
thanks for having me on.
We are going to do a lot more episodes with Kate moving forward, supplementation, and yeah, just a lot more nutritional stuff for runners.
Great.
As we talked about the hormone stuff, which will be really interesting. So yeah, please stay tuned to these episodes because I'm learning heaps. I hope everyone else is. Just to recap, Kate's website, please fire away.
Athlete Sanctuary. So one S between the athlete and the sanctuary.com.au.
Beautiful. Kate consults in Carlton in Melbourne in Janjuk.
Yes.
Torquay or Janjuk?
Yep.
Janjuk.
And in Ballarat.
And in Ballarat. So she's in three locations around Victoria. You can consult with her over Skype. Yeah, she's very accessible. She is just an absolute wealth of knowledge. And she's certainly helped my running and my health over the years, which I'm very grateful for. So thanks, Kate.
Oh, you're very welcome. So and lovely to be here.
Good on you. Speak to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Could have been not bound, but here I stand, a man whose roots he understands, and I'm going to hold my head up high. I was told as a young man, doesn't matter if you're white or black, just show love to everyone you meet, doesn't matter if it don't come back. Oh, no.